I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Harriet Tubman is having her moment, finally, with new biographies. The recent movie, Harriet, the design for a new Harriet Tubman stamp, and a new play written by Lorene Carey, My General Tubman, that's having its debut at the Arden Theater in Philadelphia through March 8th. Harriet Tubman suffered from lifelong spells or seizures, probably epilepsy, after being hit in the head and seriously injured as a child. Lorene Carey's play toggles back and forth between time and place, imagining where those spells would take Harriet Tubman. She time travels between the Civil War South and a detention center in today's Philadelphia, where Tubman recruits soldiers to join her fight for freedom. The play is also about reaching into the past to save our ancestors and perhaps rewrite history. I'm excited that we are putting on our own play today about My General Tubman with an audience here at WHYY, featuring a conversation with Lorene Carey, director James Imes, and a reading by two of the actors, Danielle Lanay, who plays Harriet Tubman, and Brandon Pierce, who plays Nelson Davis, who became Tubman's husband. Let's give them a big round of applause. I just have to add, it's really great to have an audience, and we'll talk about playwriting and radio and all that stuff a little bit later on in the hour. But Lorene, let me start with you. You wrote a best-selling memoir. You've written novels. You started Art Sanctuary. You sat on the School Reform Commission. You teach at the University of Pennsylvania. You wrote an opera about your Nana. When did becoming a playwright occur to you? And why?
I just quoted, my mom just came in, I just quoted my mom.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, who, to James, my mom, who used to say when I sat under the table and just made up stories, to go outside and stop being weird.
Oh.
plays always felt less weird than being by yourself in a room making up people. I was never able to do it because I wasn't able to figure out how to do life and that very intense kind of collaboration.
Right, which is so different. I mean,
it's so different.
Writing is so solitary.
Yeah, right. It always felt to me like my own version of having places that are. I love learning about autism. I love learning about the spectrum of it, and the squeeze machine that Temple Grandin made so that she could feel like pushing herself against this wood. Mm-hmm. She could feel what other people felt when they were hugged. For me, writing has always been a little like a squeeze machine, and I think I have had to grow into. What my brother-in-law calls an extrovert skill set, so that I wouldn't be weird.
But I was thinking, you don't watch people read your books,
no.
But you are watching people perform your play.
That's different. I'm not watching them perform my play. They are collaborators.
Right.
They change the play. They change this. So like opera, you do a libretto, and then somebody else sets it to music, and... You know, when you're a jet all the way. From your first cigarette to your... I mean, who cares, right? But then when you hear... it just go. That's what these people do. So you write something and it's sort of... And then they try it and it's better. And then you see how you need to try to rewrite it to really make it pop. They are collaborators. They don't just do your play.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. James, let me get you in on the conversation. And I have to say, I've gotten several iterations of the play over time, and I can see there's been a lot of rewriting going on. But when you first got the play, what were your thoughts? What did you think Lorene wanted to do?
I thought the ideas were really, really exciting. I was like, oh, well, one, I didn't know that Harriet Tubman had spells and... I was like, well, what a fabulous device that sort of offers you the ability to do anything. Like, suddenly, like, the possibilities of where she can go and who she can talk to and who she can meet was really exciting for me. And it was also like, I mean, I love plays. Like, I love the form. I think the art form is one of the oldest literary art forms we have. And there's a reason that that's the first thing we decided to do is to embody stories. And so I felt like this script had a lot of opportunity to create the world, but also felt like it would give actors an incredible opportunity to like inhabit this world in an exciting way. So those were the things that sort of like grabbed me about it.
The stage is very plain. There are a couple of chairs, obviously by design. Mm-hmm. What was your thinking behind that?
I wanted to feature the acting and I wanted to feature the story. So I wanted the world to be supportive of that. And as you know, I hate to use the word minimalist because I don't really think I'm a minimalist director. Sometimes I throw everything on stage. But I do think that you don't need a whole lot to tell a story. And the audience, I believe really deeply in the audience's ability to imagine with the performance and to create with the performers and create with the play. And so they carry a bit of the playwriting, not really the playwriting, but they carry a bit of the production in them. Like it's, you know, it's like Roland Barthes talks about like your Catcher in the Rye, your Great Gatsby, your Beloved. I think I want audiences to have that same experience as with plays that they experience that I direct.
Well, it's called My General Tubman. I mean, this is, Lorraine, this is...
That's part of the idea.
Well, exactly. Yeah, Can you expand on that? Because I think if you watch the play, then she becomes my General Tubman.
Yes.
Or
yes.
As you act Harriet Tubman, she's your General Tubman.
Sure, sure. I just want to underscore something that James did right from the start, from our first design meeting, before we even rehearsed. It's not... Part of the reason it's not minimalist is because there's such attention to the very design of the walls and the stage. And then on the other end, after rehearsal, all of that is bookmarked by attention to, very precise attention to lighting, attention to sound, movement, music, song, all of the sounds of it. There's a moment when Harriet goes out and she takes her knapsack off a hook. And I love that. It's determined, it's quiet, you almost don't even notice it, but they had to decide to put a hook on the back of the screen so it could be there. They had to decide when she would pick it. I mean, James is always thinking about, when do you see her? What does that do to you? And he'll say to me, what would it look like if she were there right at the beginning? In the play, I didn't have her there right in the beginning. I had her after a long time. And then she would appear. And he said, what if the story tells us what kind of story it will be right from the beginning?
Well, that's it.
And I thought to myself, oh, Christ.
Here we go again. Another rewrite, right?
How? Yeah.
But drumming is also such an important part of the play, just the sound of the play. Mm-hmm. But we know certainly during slavery, drumming was how enslaved people spoke to each other. Was that part of your thinking as well, James?
Well, the drumming is very much a part of the play, and it was very important to Lorraine's vision of how the play worked, how the play functioned. And what developed out of the process is Harriet Tubman's attachment to the drumming, that the drumming was a thing that sort of was like calling her. But then it became this thing that they could use to, well, I don't want to give it away.
No, we don't want to give too much away.
But the drumming becomes like essential to the storytelling. And, in many cultures in all across Africa, drumming is a big part of how people communicate with each other, but also like how people understand each other. And so it made really complete sense to me. And we do this really great thing in the sound design, where the sound design is a layering of many different kinds of drumming. There's like djembe, but there's also a 808, which is a hip-hop drumming sound and feeling. And I felt like that was like really important to connect those two things because they're so connected.
And for the audience to sort of just feel the rhythm of the play through the drumming.
Also true, Asia, Africa, someplace South America, Caribbean, drumming calls ancestors. That it's from the beginning of time. We have had, I always think of it as like the screen door in our little house in West Philly. I always felt that outside that screen door, just there, that there were ancestors. That's where my great-grandfather's people from Barbados were. That's where the people from North Carolina. That's just an ancient feeling from people all over the world. We're the ancestors, and it's a little like heartbeat. Yeah.
There's so many ways to tell the story of Harriet Tubman, and there's so much to tell, but you chose this very specific part of her persona, the fact that she had these either seizures or spells or epilepsy, we don't exactly know what to call them, but nonetheless, she would in a sense disappear into we don't know where. Why did that interest you?
She would just do it 3 to 5 minutes. I loved it's called temporal lobe epilepsy, temporal meaning the place for time. And she herself said, a month or two after the accident, she heard music tumbling from the sky. Yeah. She felt as if she were able to fly across country towns and fields. And she said sometimes she felt like she was allowed to touch the mind of God. I mean, like you could... So she sent me back to Einstein. Back the thing of how does time happen? How does light move around? What, you know, the prologue says, time bends now. Mm. That is from her. That is from Einstein. That's the way. Time, like light, goes around us. So if she sits in the middle, then we can go back and forward. Mm. And it's not just that we go back and help out there, but she comes here and also helps us with many of the things that are wrong with us.
Yes, many. And there are some things that we should talk about. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Lorraine Carey. We're talking about her new play. It's her debut play, My General Tubman. It's at the Arden Theater through the beginning of March. Playwright James Imes is with us as well. And after this very short break, we're going to hear from actors Danielle Linnae and Brandon Pierce, a reading from My General Tubman. And we have a live audience here at WHYY listening along with you as we carry on our conversation after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking about this new play, My General Tubman, with Lorraine Carey. She's the playwright. She's also an author, wrote a book most recently, Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. Her memoir, Black Ice, was a bestseller. Her novels include The Price of a Child, Pride, and If Sons, Then Heirs, and a collection of stories for young readers titled Free, Great Escapes from Slavery on the Underground Railroad. She teaches writing at the University of Pennsylvania. She founded Art Sanctuary and sat on the School Reform Commission. James Imes is director of My General Tubman, again making its debut at the Arden Theater. He's a Philadelphia-based performer, playwright, and director. His plays have been produced by the Wilma Theater, Orbiter 3, Theater, Horizon, Steppenwolf Theater, and Villanova University. He's also won a number of Barrymore Awards for acting and for directing, and is assistant professor of theater at Villanova University. Danielle Lene plays Harriet Tubman in My General Tubman. She's an actor and a teaching artist and has appeared in The Arden's Gem of the Ocean, the off-Broadway production of White Guy on a Bus, and the People's Light and Theater's production of Diary of an Anne Frank. And Brandon Pierce plays Nelson Davis in My General Tubman. He's a theater actor who's appeared in the plays Skeleton Crew, Sweat, Kilmore Paradise, and Peter Pan. We're going to have a reading from the play from our two actors here. And James, I wonder if you could just set this up for our listeners.
Totally. This is sort of the top of the second half of the play. And Harriet's been moving quite a bit at this point in the story. And Nelson has found himself in medical isolation because he's being retested for tuberculosis because he's had a latent reading of tuberculosis. And so it's a moment of them coming together without anyone else around, which is special.
Yeah.
Nelson, it's me.
You look tired.
Maybe I sat for a minute.
Where were you before you came here?
Virginia, Maryland, farms, plantations, woods. Pulled up lame time I got to Philadelphia. I was on my way to New Bedford. Lady there helps me to raise money and gives me a place to rest sometimes.
You can rest here as well as you can up there. Lie back.
I only got a week and a half. Sometimes when I get like this, I go down for a month.
So you're not just tired, you're about to be ill.
Nah, I'ma hold off getting sick till we get through this next thing. Use my mind to serve this busted up body.
Let me see what's left of those boots. Oh my God, look at your bare little feet.
You got anything I can put inside the boots? I found a few plantations ready to jump up. We only need just a few, and then they're the anchors. They help me figure who can keep their mouths shut, who can bring other ones. Walk and wait and talk and wait and walk and watch. I can't go to sleep here. What if he needs to go early?
Christ, John Brown.
How you know it's Captain Brown? Did I say John Brown?
You must have. But he wouldn't go without you. All your preparation, those black people on the plantations, they won't go without a sign from you. He's got to know that. Unless...
Unless what? You know something? He's going early, isn't he? This is to stop slavery. How in the name of God do you...
It's not going to work, General. You are not going to go. He will take hostages and the enslaved people will not rise up.
No, you don't know that. Where is your faith? I need your faith. We are making a way out of no way, and they say I got the charm.
You make a way. You've shown up here in the future, and all this already happened. Him, he fights, and he's going to lose. There is no charm, and you weren't there.
Well, maybe I should have been. Maybe that could have changed things. I don't know what you're talking about. You're not making fun of me, are you? John Tubman used to say I was slow, but I'm not slow. If you know the future, did you know I was coming here just now?
No, I'm from the future. I don't know things unless they were written down somewhere.
And what does your book say about us black people? We are in the valley of death, our backs against the wall. Does your book say that? I thought you wanted to escape, not talk me down. I wanted things here with you I shouldn't. Maybe God is punishing me. Maybe I deserve it.
You've got to stay alive.
Staying alive isn't as important as living right.
Wow. Fabulous. It works so well on the radio, I have to say. Beautiful, beautiful. Don't you think, James?
Yeah, I was trying to find the right one for radio. Some of them really need to be seen to get. So
yeah, it's beautiful.
You missed the feet, though. You didn't see her bare feet.
No, I know. There were certainly things. Daniel, I'm just curious about how you think of Harriet Tubman and also her voice. I mean, we don't know what she sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot about trying to connect to the spirit of who she is to me. And in terms of, like, her voice, I think you have to think in terms of, like, what the audience kind of needs to hear in order to believe the time that we're in. And to set that kind of space, and we kind of talked about these women who exude confidence, who exude, they just have this poiseness to them. And so I was thinking of women like Felicia Rashad and Diane Carroll and, you know, all of these women who they just come in and the space is theirs. And so I tried to tap into that a little bit and I think I didn't want to sound too contemporary to our ears, so I feel like deepening the voice a little bit, adds a little texture that makes us feel like we can touch who she is a little. So, yeah.
And you did. I mean, it's a wonderful performance. How about for you, Brandon? How did you think about your character?
You know, it's interesting because where my character starts and where he ends, he goes on such a journey to become this man that Harriet eventually marries.
And he's young. He's a young man.
He is a young man.
He's 20 years younger than I am, I think.
20 years younger, yeah.
Yes, and he has a young mentality at the start of the play that, you know, trying to find that and develop it and also becoming this man that Harriet Tubman actually married in real life. So, you know, tracking that journey and finding where he becomes this sort of, you know, this very energetic and very angry young man to somebody who, you know, is a little bit more poised and firm within himself towards the end of it.
And there's this time travel thing you have to figure out as well. And I was watching you as you were Harriet Tubman and she goes into these reveries or these spells or we don't know where. As an actor, where did you go when you did that? I was curious as I was watching you.
That's so funny. So many different places, actually. Sometimes I imagine my thoughts going outside of the building and I'm passing Christ Church and I literally imagine, like, how far can I span Philadelphia? Other times I think about my grandmother and I think about my great grandmother and I try to go back into memories and see how far I can span the memories. And we talked, I know, with James a lot about it's not just staring, it's like you're going beyond. And so I always take those times to see how beyond I can go before I come back.
Before
I need to blink.
Yes, exactly. And you do, in the program notes, grandmother, this is for you always.
Yeah, my grandma.
Which is really nice.
Yeah. She was a print model, actually, and she was my first introduction to arts. And so she always enjoyed, you know, seeing me perform and just always had a strong belief in what I could become. And so I always imagine that I take her with me wherever I go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
James, you also write in the program notes, another thing I offer as a way into this play is the fact that Harriet Tubman was beautiful. I mean this in all the ways we use the term. I will say it again, Harriet Tubman was beautiful.
Mm. Yeah. When I look at pictures of Harriet Tubman, she looks exactly like my great-grandmother. And my great-grandmother was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that's not an honorific we often offer to Black women, period, but specifically Black women who are darker complected and have stronger features. And so I wanted people to sit in the audience and sort of grapple with that. Like, she's beautiful. And Danielle is, of course, beautiful.
That helps.
But the imagination of Harriet we have is one that we sort of automatically align with something that is unattractive, and I don't think that that is true. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to say that and have an audience read it and go, okay, that's how I'm entering into this story. Yeah.
And Lorraine, I mean, she was so many things, of course. An abolitionist, bringing enslaved people out of the South, going back again time and time again. She was, I believe you have said, the first, maybe only female general that fought for the United States. I forget the exact wording, but I mean, it's so interesting to think, where did she get this courage, this determination, this willingness to put herself on the line time and time again?
She says she was called by God.
Right. Almost as simple as that.
It's that simple. That's how she understood it. And I don't feel competent to psychoanalyze her in some other way. She did the work. She's telling us how she did it. Good job.
Yeah. An understatement, yes. But you are, as she time travels in this play, you are also making a connection between slavery and the criminal justice system. Can you speak? I want all of you to speak to that, but I'm curious, Lorraine, about what you're saying there.
And it's not just me saying it. We know that many of the structures that we have created we call it criminal justice system. It is not always just. Mm-hmm. We know that many of them came out of the efforts during Jim Crow to make sure that the newly freed people would be made again into a stationary, cheap workforce with no other options. We know that that's why some of the vagrancy law, I mean, you can be very specific. Legislators said it at the time. So how do you re-enslave people? Well, you make everything they do a crime. You put them into prisons. You put them on work gangs. You do the work of the government and of corporations using their unpaid labor. And then when they're out, you take away their vote, so that they are disenfranchised. I haven't made the connection. We have connected slavery to our justice system. And we have learned how to do structures that teach us all kinds of things that we use. We use it now in our immigration. We use it now in any structure where we want to control people. We have learned how to do it through slavery and through the structures that came after it.
There's a book, it's not so new anymore, The New Jim Crow, that came out about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Thinking about the war on drugs, I'm looking at you, James, the war on drugs, I mean, and on and on and on, where African Americans just got pulled into this system of incarceration.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of how America is founded in these founding documents a few years ago, because I'm this person, I was reading the debates at the Constitutional Congress that happened not far from here, like right there.
Yeah.
And I'm going to mangle this quote from James Madison, but he was talking about the Senate, and the function of the Senate was to maintain the minority of the opulent.
Mm-hmm. Say that again.
To maintain the minority of the opulent. So there's structures in our federal government that are built to make sure that there are people who have and people who have not. And so there's something in the structure that is dependent on a group of people being disenfranchised. And we have to begin to really, truly rethink that. And that's a bigger project than a play can do. But I think inside of the play is this real conversation that what is old is not so old. and that history doesn't really repeat itself, but it rhymes. I think that's Mark Twain.
Yeah. I'm curious, Danielle and Brandon, whether how much what Lorraine and James were just saying, how much that figured into your thinking about your characters.
I think it's definitely a part of us telling the story. It's for me, I do some work in the prison, and I have some ladies who may come into our classroom and they're exhausted, and I'm like, why are you tired? And they're like, well, yesterday I spent 15 hours working. I was like, oh, wow, that's a long day. And they're like, yeah, we make 13 cents an hour. And I'm like, I couldn't imagine that. So, I mean, I think all of the things you guys have been saying and the story that we're trying to tell, yeah, it's inevitable that you receive the thoughts of this being a slave pen, you know?
How about for you, Brandon?
I mean, there's definitely that parallel within the play, and it drives some of the characters' journeys. I mean, Nelson has a line early in the play where he makes the comparison of he doesn't want to learn about the ropes in prison because it's the way they control black people, like they've been doing since Jim Crow. There's another character in the play, Earl, who is constantly coming back to prison. He's, you know, over and over again, he's just caught in a cycle of it. And it gets to this point where these guys need someone like Harriet Tubman to come and liberate them from the situation. Like, that's how bad it is.
That you need Harriet Tubman to come from the past and help deal with this. Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Brandon Pierce. He appears in the new play, My General Tubman. Also, Danielle Linnea is with us as well. She's an actor in this new play. Also talking with James Imes, director of My General Tubman. It had its debut at the Arden Theater, and it's there through the beginning part of March. And Lorraine Carey is with us as well. She's the playwright of My General Tubman. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We do have a room full of WHYY listeners, and they've given us a bunch of questions. We'll sort of work those into our conversation after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Mosco.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with the creative people behind this new play, My General Tubman. Before I take some of these questions here, Lorraine actually just whispered something in my ear about Harriet Tubman that she wanted to talk about. This notion of shame, even self-hatred. Help us
sure.
Roll that into our conversation.
I just wanted to put on the other side of the legal. I mean, there's legal oppression. There's state-sanctioned violence to enforce legal injustice. But there's also cultural, psychological shame, right? There's this shame about having been enslaved. There's shame that goes along with color. There's shame that comes, I mean, when James says that we don't think that America doesn't say that women who are dark-skinned are beautiful, there's shame. Well, why not? I mean, right? So that's also what Tubman comes to sort of redeem. Oh, I'm sorry. I keep hitting James's microphone for those on the radio.
Lorraine uses her hands, which I can relate to completely.
Are you going to move your mic?
I want you to be expressive.
Yeah, don't hold back.
But that that has dogged our lives. And many, many, many African-American thinkers have said things like, if you what was the quote, if you teach a person that he has to come through the back door, then you know you don't have to tell him anymore. He'll just use it himself. There are all these. That's what shame does. Shame does its own oppression. And then in families, in relationships, are those structures. So that's what Nelson is fighting against when he says, you know, there's a new photo of her out. I love that one. And every time he does it, I feel watered. I feel like I'm parched ground who has been watered by that.
Well, hopefully we'll get a Harriet Tubman stamp sometime soon. Something for maybe a different discussion. But let me read some of the questions from our audience. Why time travel, i.e. Tubman's story, is interesting as it is? Are you trying to tie her story into today, or was there some other motivation? We touched on this briefly, but it's such an interesting way of trying to tell this story of Harriet Tubman.
Why time travel? That's, to me, that question, I guess.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know why stories come the way they come. Partly it's a way for me. I spend a lot of my mental life in the past, in 18th, 19th centuries and further back. It's a way of saying these ancestors are not so far away. Their lives are close. It gives the experience for me of the first time I read Latin was, you know, omnia gallae in tres partes est, right? Caesar is there, poof, there I was in France with the Gauls. That's part of what this play wants to say. Right. Poof.
James, I ran across a quote from you. I'm preoccupied with inheritance and legacy. What do we get from those who came before us? What do we leave behind? I mean, in many ways, this is exactly what this play is about.
Yeah, I mean, I deal a lot in anachronism in the art that I make, because I think what it instantly does is it makes people confront exactly what Lorene just said, is that the past is with us. We want, and I think it's a particularly American phenomenon of like the past sort of being there, and then we're doing our thing, like it's this interest in modernity and an unwillingness to sort of like carry the past, whereas like you go to Paris and it's like everything is ancient. You know, you walk into Notre Dame, you know, and it's like, oh, this has been here for a very long time. The architecture changes because it took them so long to make it.
Yeah.
Like there's an appreciation for and a love for what has happened, and it helps to understand the present. And so I think that's why it's super valuable. And also, I love science fiction, and time travel is awesome and fun. And like, you know, it opens up the possibility of storytelling. And I want to just like do a tiny little like shout out to Michelle Valansky, who was the dramaturg on this production,
please,
who really helped us with the math of time travel,
please,
and like
please,
figuring out how it works. And she's like one of the preeminent dramaturgs in the country. So I just wanted to make sure I spoke her name.
Yeah.
Now I'm hitting myself with the mic.
That's great. Yeah.
And so Michelle Valansky, as our dramaturg, has helped me enormously, just enormously. Terry Nolan also helped enormously early on, before we had a dramaturg at the Arden, saying, well, if you are sort of resting this time travel Harriet Tubman story on Henry V, which I was, well, think about having a narrator.
Oh, there you go.
So that you have a liaison to help the audience back and forth.
Here's a question actually both for Danielle and Brandon from Gretchen, who says, if Harriet were to attend a performance of your play, what do you think her reaction would be? And I'll just add, and how intimidating would that be for you?
Oh, wow. You know, on our, I think it was our designer or dress run, Pay What You Can Decide, Pay What You Decide night, we had a one of Harriet Tubman's great, great nephew there.
Oh, really?
Right. Yes.
And one of her descendants, and he spoke to me after the show, and with like tears in his eyes, he was thanking me, and he said you and that other one, I think he was referring to Cynthia Erivo.
Oh, in the movie. Oh.
Yeah, he was like, the other one from the movie.
Nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
Yes, right.
Right. he said, you guys have really brought the spirit of my auntie back to life. And it was so moving and powerful to watch. And I think my soul is still floating in the rafters of the theater from that comment. But I would hope that she would sit there and say, wow, we embodied a part of her story. And if not the entirety of the story, but some of those tender moments that we don't always get to see of her.
Yeah, the tender moments.
Yeah.
Brandon, your thoughts?
I mean, I would imagine she'd be a little confused by the time travel stuff, but...
Apparently she liked riding in a buggy, right? In modern day Philadelphia.
But I think she would, I would hope that she would really vibe with the humanity that the piece is really getting to. You know, these people, you know, the play is about these people that need each other really to make a way in life or and out of their situations. And, you know, it would be a little intimidating if I knew she was in the audience. But.
Let me read another question. How do you prepare for developing your character from a historical lens? What character development strategies did you use? How long did it take to write the play from concept to final script? Let me just start with the first part about just, there's all this history, obviously, but this is also a play about a certain kind of Harriet Tubman. Do you read a lot of books and...
Oh, okay, because I was going to say I clocked out for a second. But...
like Harry, right?
I heard this is for Lorraine, and so I... I'm guessing that you were talking about before preparing for like the historical part of, aspect of it. I emailed Lorraine about like things, references, books that I should read, because I know there were books that people wrote for her, and they, you know, heightened her story for the sake of the audiences they were trying to sell that story to at the time and to help raise money for her. So I wanted something that was as honest as possible. So I listened to some podcasts. I read a couple books that she mentioned, and she gave me a book by Erica Dunbar.
Oh, yes.
Erica Thompson. She came to slay. And you know, these are all like lovely perspectives of her story. I think I can't remember the name of the book that you had recommended, but this particular book did not only talked about Harriet Tubman's life, but also talked about like her history, like what she came from, her grandmother Modesty, and how they kind of got to Dorchester, Maryland, and then talked a little bit about the area and what was going on there and like what was surrounding it, touched on John Brown briefly, but that was really fascinating, where I got to really see kind of like a fuller picture of the time and who she was during that time.
That's Kate Larson's excellent biography called The Moses of Her People.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. By Kate Larson. It's excellent.
It's so fantastic.
Here's a question. How do you create imagined history without compromising historical facts for young audiences or for those new to the Harriet Tubman story? I mean, I think we're still learning things about Harriet Tubman, but you imagine a certain part of her interior life, I would say, as she time travels and disappears and reappears. Did you feel like you were playing with history?
Yeah, we had a constant conversation about that. Anytime you write anything, you have changed the facts. Right now, if all of us were to write a blog about what happened in this room in the last 53 minutes, we're all going to have different versions of it. We're going to omit things. So just knowing that gives me an incredible amount of humility about trying to tell any story. And then you collaborate with people, and you sort of argue, say, well, I think this is really important in this way. And, you know, James will say, well, I think that's acted already. You don't have to have people say it. I think this, you know, so you go back and forth about it. But I hope to have integrity in the mm-hmm. telling of her story. I hope not to change. This is sounds like a stupid. I don't want to change any facts. Right, like she came to Philadelphia Detention Center. That's a big fact. I changed. But the act, you know, Charles Nelson Davis, when they got married, when John Brown died, the fact that she met him, the two of them talked, he did want her to come. People did think she did have to go with her family to Canada afterwards because of the investigation. Like all those things. Then it's a question of emphasis.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah, James, go ahead.
Well, there's a long tradition of historical plays in mm-hmm. the theater. I mean, like, Shakespeare wrote several of them, none of them are accurate. I mean, they have a lot of facts in them, but they're not the actual, you know. And so I think that's what the theater gives you, is the ability to play. And, you know, our obligation is to entertain people. So if the truth is not as entertaining as...
oh, this is totally where we get to.
I think we're getting a window into it.
Like, but you're right, yeah. Yeah.
So but is it going to get the laugh?
Yeah.
But she was funny.
Yeah, she was funny.
That's the great thing that helps us. She was really funny.
That does help. Yeah. James, how hard is it for the play to come out after the movie? Does that help? Does it hurt? Do you wish you'd written things differently? But does that matter? I mean, are we in a kind of Harriet Tubman moment, do you think?
I mean, I do think the movie helped, because I think there's sort of like an excitement around her story. But the mediums are so different. Right. Like a movie's objective is to do a slightly different thing than a play is. So I think... It's great to sort of have that excitement in the world around her and her story, but I think when people come to see this play, they're going to have a very different engagement with her than you would experience in the movie. I haven't seen the movie.
Oh, I didn't. That's okay.
I didn't see it until I had done revision. And one thing I feel movie does is movies require triumph, mm-hmm. which is for me is a different. Right. Different thing from my experience of reading about her life.
Yeah.
We are almost out of time. I'm looking at the clock here. Lorraine, is there another play working on you? Or are you working on another play? Or has this opened up a whole new world for you?
It has opened another world for me. I had a story that I was thinking of as a young adult novel. It might be more fun as a play. I don't know. We'll see.
How about for you, James?
I have things. I'm directing the last show at the Wilma Theater. It's a play called Is God Is by Alicia Harris. So that's the next directing job for me. And then I'm writing a ton.
Yeah. You've been writing plays since you were 13, I think.
Yeah, I wrote my first play when I was 13. Uh-huh. So I've been living with the form for a long time.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. I can't thank you enough for joining us today on Radio Times and talking about this extraordinary play, and having you perform a piece from the play, really, it means a lot to us. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our guests have been Lorraine Carey, James Imes, Danielle Linnae, Brandon Pierce. And the play, My General Tubman, is at the Arden Theater through March 8th. Thanks for joining us for today's special edition of Radio Times. We're always live, but having a real live audience makes it even more exciting and more fun. We've been tweeting during the broadcast, and we'll post photos from today's show on our Facebook page. Thanks to WHYY's Emily Kinslow, Christine Holbert, Tori Harris, Sakina Benjamin for their assistance on today's interview. Our engineers, Joyce Lieberman, Adam Stanishevsky, and Diana Martinez. The Radio Times producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us.